Tracy.
Edit audio.
You look back at that now, and certainly when reviewing the case, and think that that's not the way to run a homicide case. And, you know, really, I think there was a lot of top-down management and not handing this over to investigators and letting them run with the ball. People that investigate cases every day, sometimes they need room to work. If there's one thing that case taught me in the review was let your good people do their job.
In the last episode of the Springfield 3,
I mean, it was anyone's guess of who truly was. And I think what was frustrating for people is get to the point, in every investigation is this way, you have a list of people. Eliminate some of those on the list. At least get them off, you know, track them down. And I don't know that that ever happened. I mean, have they ever eliminated Robert Craig Cox? No. Not to my knowledge. I've talked to them a couple of years ago. And have they eliminated the group of boys? I don't think so.
So let's recap potential suspects. We have the young grave robbers, one of whom was Susie's ex-boyfriend. She was allegedly to testify against him in court. We have Steve Garrison, the prisoner who told police his friend had confessed to killing the three women during a party. There's Larry Hall, a serial killer who was suspected of murdering somewhere around 50 women. He was a Civil War buff who could have possibly been in the Springfield area at the time. There's Gerald Carnahan, the Springfield businessman who murdered beauty queen Jackie Johns. And there's Robert Craig Cox, the former Army Ranger convicted for the murder of Sharon Zellers. None of these men have been convicted of the kidnappings of Susie, Stacy, and Cheryl. I want to know what happened during this investigation, and why we can't find the person or persons who committed this crime.
Normally, the leads direct you. What comes in, you go after it. You talk to people, and you go in a very methodic way. And this was not methodic.
This is the Springfield 3, a podcast about the disappearance of three women who forever changed a small Missouri town and the people in it. In this episode, I'm going to explore exactly what happened with the police department. And to be clear, every member of law enforcement that worked with us on this podcast, like Rick Bookout and David Millsap and David Asher, they want nothing more than to solve this case. The same with Daryl Moore. These guys have done countless interviews over the decades, some of them years after being retired, all in hopes that it could possibly lead to finding out what happened to Stacy, Susie, and Cheryl. I read Rick Bookout's initial incident report on this case, which was thorough and extensive at 5 pages long with meticulous attention to detail. Journalist Robert Keyes remembered the report as well.
This officer, his name was Rick Bookout, he wrote a phenomenal police report because I think he was the first officer who actually had been called to the house. And he wrote a very, I thought, as I recall, really very detailed report as to what he observed. And I'll never forget it because we didn't know, we don't know what happened, but it was so good because there was so much information in it. You could really just see inside that house. So I kind of used that as a setting to say, this is what it looked like when somebody came to the house. The blinds were slightly peeked up or something, and just things that may or may not be relevant to what happened to the girls, but things that just sort of cast a sense of, this was the setting.
Like securing any interview, there are some people involved in this case that didn't want to participate. Some of the law enforcement was retired and some have passed away. This case is nearly 30 years old after all. And there are some that just didn't want anything to do with this. There are people like reporter Dennis Graves, who said that it was just too painful to revisit. I get that. The Springfield police have their own PR department. It's where interview requests like mine are fielded. I reached out to them back in January of 2020 in hopes to speak with someone about this case. I was told that they have recently done several media interviews that have not created much traction in the investigation. So after speaking to the major at Criminal Investigations Division, they decided to, quote, opt out at this time. I guess I'm a little confused as to why the police department is dependent on the media to create traction in this case. And if it were not solved or created traction from one of the stories, does this mean that all others are off limits? And if the goal is to create traction, wouldn't a podcast be a way to reach a larger audience? But I kept trying and I kept getting denied. They told me via email that if I'd like to check back in a couple of months, the newly assigned detectives will be more familiar and better equipped to speak about the case. In my most recent correspondence, I was given permission to email some questions. 3 months later, I'm still waiting to get answers. Daryl Moore was the chief assistant prosecutor in Greene County in 1992. He's currently the executive director for the Missouri Association of Prosecuting Attorneys. In other words, he's worked on a lot of criminal investigations over the years and has worked on some pretty horrifying cases. Daryl Moore grew up in Springfield, and he still lives there. He knows that the Springfield Police Department is still working this case.
I mean, I told the McCalls through the years that we would continue to work it, and the police departments continued to work it. And we followed up on every plausible lead that we could to try to get resolution for both families, and unfortunately, it's not happened. In spite of repeated publicity and television coverage and stuff and asking people to come forward.
So if we can't speak to anyone currently at the Springfield PD, we'll have to look back to find out if anything went wrong. If you remember, Janice McCall and her husband Stuart arrived at the Delmar home around 9 p.m. on the night of June 7th. Officer Rick Bookout arrived to the Delmar house later that night.
A couple guys drove up in a patrol car, and one was Officer Bookout, and they came up and I explained the situation. I told them what was going on, and they kind of did a brief look around in the house and saw nothing was there. And they were probably shocked because there were so many people there. Well, about this time, part of the kids went home, and because they wanted to go and get something to eat, they'd been gone and all this stuff. So it was mainly just a couple people and my husband and I and my daughters. And by this time, it was 10:15.
This means that nearly 24 hours have passed since the three women went missing. And this makes sense. These sort of crimes don't happen in Springfield, Missouri, which is why everyone flocked to the house when the women couldn't be found. We know that the most likely place of the disappearance was at Cheryl and Susie's home at 1717 Delmar. The initial police report from Officer Rick Bookout states that by the time law enforcement had arrived, the following people were at the scene: Janelle Kirby, Mike Henson, Stuart and Janice McCall, and their daughters Meredith and Lisa, Adina, a friend of Stacy and Susie's, and her mother Darlene, and Janelle's parents, Randy and Kathy Kirby.
When I responded to the address, as I recall, there were a lot of people there. There were adults, there were kids, people coming in and out of the house, people in the yard.
Rick Bookout's report states, quote, "Upon attempting to conduct an investigation of the house, Officer Brian Galt and I were advised by subjects present that they had already cleaned up the glass and looked in the purses and around the residence prior to our arrival. 10 people had been in the small house. They'd emptied ashtrays and washed dishes. They'd walked around the house, touched surfaces, and answered the telephone. And they swept up the glass, the one possible sign that something was amiss or that there was any struggle in the home. How was it broken? Had the perpetrator tried to remove the bulb and inadvertently broken the glass dome?"
Well, I think just the fact that so many people were there and had been there at different times, you know, I think that compromises a crime scene.
David Millsap was lieutenant of the Springfield Police Department when they helped reorganize the case years later. He had a unique perspective. He had time to look back on what happened in the first hours, days, and months of the investigation.
Well, there were a few things that happened in the case, which is somewhat unique. By the time the Springfield Police Department got its initial report that the women were missing, when the initial officers arrived on scene, there were some 10 people already in the crime scene. So right then, the crime scene was somewhat corrupt. And most of those were family and friends of the three missing women. So they didn't go there with the idea of corrupting that crime scene. So all of a sudden now you're behind the eight ball because you don't have a crime scene to really work with as pristine as it should have been.
But like Daryl Moore points out, you can't fault the family for going into the crime scene.
Well, you know, there's always going to be speculation because We don't know if anything would have been found because, as you said, when the relatives and friends first showed up over at the house because they couldn't contact anybody, they really didn't think that anything sinister or evil had happened. I mean, that would be the first, but let's be real, in 1992 in Springfield, Missouri, you wouldn't think anything like that would happen here. And so out of natural reflex, they move some things, they do some cleanup. And so there may not have been anything found. I mean, you don't want to be critical of family and friends for doing something that at the time would have seemed natural.
Once inside the home, the telephone rang. It's been said by multiple people that lewd comments were made and that there were multiple calls and that a message was accidentally deleted. I've asked almost everyone we've interviewed in this series about those calls, but no one had an answer if they meant anything or who could have even made them. Could more have been done if we had this evidence? So with the crime scene tampered, police were already off to a rocky start. And to make matters worse, with a crime like this, time is crucial. Here's Daryl Moore again.
Those first few hours, you know, there's a TV show called 48 Hours. The premise is that if you're going to solve especially a homicide case, that those first 48 hours are critical. And the reality is in any criminal investigation, the beginning. So I would say the midnight hours into the early morning hours they're taking back in June of 1992, those were the critical hours. Everything was critical.
Sheriff Millsap explained what was happening in the police department in those first few hours.
There was a report made on the Sunday that the girls were missing, and that the Springfield Police Department arrived on the scene somewhere around 10 p.m. The report was written, did not get to criminal investigations until the next morning. And that was in the process of how things were done, that was not unusual. The case would be taken by, preliminary report would be taken by patrol. It would be sent to criminal investigations. A sergeant would review it for assignment. So it was either a Monday or Tuesday before criminal investigations, I think, had the case. And so there was probably a time lapse of about 24 hours before a detective was assigned to the case.
But Janice McCall felt that the police weren't acting fast enough.
And then I had to go see the sergeant. They said, the sergeant wants to see you. And he said, well, you know, he leaned back in his chair and he says, why are you waiting till now to report it? Why'd you wait till now? And I very indignantly said, I didn't wait till now. I said, we reported this last night. You know, the regular patrol people came out about 9 o'clock, 9:30. And he says, well, I didn't get it on my desk till now, till recently. And I said, well, then you're going to have to talk to your people because it's not my fault. We reported it last night.
Once the town of Springfield heard about the case, it became big news. It was covered constantly by local news and then made national headlines. Here's Sheriff Millsap again.
The one thing that really stands out is too much of this was played in the media. 48 Hours, for instance, was given unbelievable access to this case as the case was evolving. They had been in Branson to do a report about the music scene at Branson at the time, which was exploding with a lot of the country music artists leaving Nashville to go to Branson. This case happens, and they immediately leave Branson, come to Springfield. They were allowed to videotape a polygraph while it was in process. When they would have briefings with the investigators, the family of the McCalls were allowed to be there during those briefings, which really stifles, I think, investigators talking about the case. There's a newspaper picture that ran in the Springfield News Leader that shows the investigative board with tips and all kinds of things up there. You look back at that now, and certainly when reviewing the case, and think that's not the way to run a homicide case.
We've heard from a few people that the media presence was helpful in spreading the word.
I mean, let's be real. Things like this, three women just disappearing and no idea why or where, natural news story. And I think that publicity is actually helpful because it spread all over, not just Greene County and Springfield, but all over Southwest Missouri, that anybody that might have seen these three women anywhere, assuming they had been kidnapped and driven off to the east or south or wherever. So I think the publicity in the beginning was very good, and I still think the publicity is good to remind people of what happened and the need to resolve this case.
But in some cases, it could have also been problematic.
I got a call from one of the assistants telling me I should look, turn on 48 hours, and what I saw was the chief of police was allowing CBS, I believe it was CBS, to record an interview with a suspect, and they may have even recorded the polygraph, maybe not the polygraph, but they were allowing the interrogation of a suspect. Totally impermissible under the ethical rules. I mean, law enforcement is bound by the same ethical rules as prosecutors in terms of releasing certain material that might prejudice a defendant's right to a fair trial.
David Asher, a detective on the case, remembered 48 hours as well.
Well, I appreciate 48 hours. I made good friends with quite a few people there, and but they got in the way. That exposure opened us up to a lot of unnecessary work and kept us from focusing maybe on things we should have been and didn't.
As you've heard, both law enforcement and local journalists have a lot of conflicting ideas about solving this case. There is, however, a common narrative, and that revolves around Terry Knowles.
A guy named Terry Knowles, who was
the Springfield police chief at the time of the disappearance. According to interviews, some people believe Terry Knowles had micromanaged the case, causing police to chase unnecessary leads. Laura Bauer was a journalist for the Springfield News Leader.
There was a belief that the police chief at the time, Terry Knowles, just took over the case. And that always, and if you would go to the police department at that time, there was a place where the detectives were and the crimes against persons unit was, and that's where the activity was. You had the sergeant over that in the early days, that was Sergeant Mark Webb, and then you would have a lieutenant, and that's where the investigation would be. Those are the people, and they're detectives. And always, in my experience covering the Springfield Police Department, always some of the most talented ones on the force would do the crimes against people. And early on, it was, nope, down the hall in the police chief's office. It was run from there.
It seemed like most people we spoke to had similar things to say about Terry Knowles. Here's journalist Ron Davis, who we've heard from in past episodes.
There was also that weird dynamic within Springfield Police. They had a new police chief, a guy named Terry Knowles, who was Mr. KBI, Mr. High Professional, and his rank and file just didn't really like or trust him much. And so there was that immediate clash of the cultures. So if Terry Knowles thought it was a big deal, many of the officers thought he was just full of it. And he looked at his officers and thought, these people don't know what they're talking about. I'm Mr. KBI. I'm Mr. Pro. And when you have that sort of dissonance between investigators and a police chief, it's not going to end well.
A 2002 article in the Springfield News Leader states that unlike any case before, detectives chased tips that came from the community, not from officers on the street. I asked Daryl Moore if this is typically how cases are handled.
No. But in the beginning, that's how it was handled. The chief certainly had a great background in law enforcement on the federal side. He had been FBI. But most investigations like this, you leave it to the trained investigators who report to you, you ask questions, and you might provide guidance. But in the beginning, he essentially micromanaged the whole investigation. And I think on occasion, well, I don't think, I know, frustrated the trained investigators. And of course, that was an incident where I think the chief took one of the suspects out for a cheeseburger at McDonald's, and based on that conversation, decided that they were not suspects.
Is that normal? I mean, why wouldn't somebody be fired for doing something like that?
Well, first of all, it's the chief of police, who was former FBI. And I'll say it was always my opinion, and I think along with most of the detectives. But the sad thing is at the time is that the police department and their criminal investigation sections had individuals in it that had many years of experience in working crime. And I've always wondered what would happen. And I'm not saying the case would have been resolved, but I've always wondered that if the career investigators had been allowed to proceed like they normally would proceed without any interference from the chief, if we might not have had a better result. But you're right, that whole thing was not normal. You don't normally take people out and get them a cheeseburger, have a conversation with them, and then based on that conversation, make a decision that they're not involved.
I spoke with Terry Knowles. He's 82 years old and retired, living out of state. Initially, Knowles declined an interview, but he called me back, asking that if I keep the questions positive, he'd speak with me. He said that a journalist had once asked him about him micromanaging the case, and he didn't want to speak of that topic. At the time of the disappearance, Knowles had been on the force for about 3 years. Prior to that, he served 24 years in the FBI and worked numerous cases of kidnappings. This was not the resume of inexperienced law enforcement. Knowles explained to me that they used a backup system where a senior officer or detective would verify a lead. He said that it was a checks and balances system. He said that they had a command post and he was giving a briefing and made aware of the ongoing developments in the case. To me, Terry Knowles seemed like a no-nonsense kind of guy. Like when I asked him how crucial time was in a case like this, he told me that all cases are different. And when I asked if he still thought about this case, he said that he did, and that he thought about other cases he worked on in Sacramento and New York City and beyond. He didn't seem emotional about this case like some of the other people I spoke with. Maybe that's because he had seen so much in his long career. What Knowles did tell me is that a time delay could have impeded this case, and that the crime scene may have been compromised by well-meaning friends and family. He told me that the Springfield PD worked with the FBI, who had up-to-date fingerprinting processing, but nothing turned up positive. He told me, "We ran out every lead." And to be fair, many of the people we spoke with, who were critical of Terry Knowles, aren't sure if the case could have gone any other way.
And you know, through the years, the police department has had the FBI and other groups that are experts in looking at cold cases, review the files, and try to see, is there something that has been missed? Is there another witness that should have been followed up on? Is there physical evidence that maybe could be tested and used? And the end result is nothing new. So while I may be critical of the original police chief involved in the case, the reality is we can't say that that adversely affected the case in the end of the day.
Looking back now, it makes me wonder, did anything in this case slip between the cracks? Were too many people involved? Would Stacy, Susie, and Cheryl be here today if the case were handled differently? Or is this just the perfect crime?
I mean, who's to say that there isn't still somebody out there that may have seen something that is relevant, or someone that may have been peripherally involved, or at least heard some chatter that out of misguided loyalty or whatever hasn't come forward? So I'd hate to call it the perfect crime, but to the extent that we have no idea on who, we have no idea on why or where these women were taken, yeah, I guess you could say so far it's the perfect crime, but there's got to be something that someday unlocks the puzzle.
On the next episode of the Springfield 3, we explore all the questions that remain.
There's no way they should still be missing. Surely somebody would have found, I mean, they're a deer hunter every year. Deer hunters are out every year. Nobody stumbled across any bones, any bits of clothing. The Ozarks may be largely uninhabited in certain places, but people are out in the woods. And nobody ran across any bones.
The Springfield 3 is an Edit Audio original production created in collaboration with Ann Roderick Jones. The series is written, researched, and hosted by Ann Roderick Jones. It was produced and edited by Ali Siawa, with executive producing from Steph Colburn, Sophie Shin, and with lots of help from the rest of the amazing Edit Audio team. Theme music was written by Patrick Rindle and Ali Siawa and was produced by Patrick Rindle at Studio Dolly. And thank you to all of those who share their stories with us. This project would not be possible without you.